first Makor is a midrash that the Baha'i quotes, talks about even before Matan Torah, there was a Torah. Okay, somewhat famous, or different people quote it in different ways, that Torah existed maybe even before the world existed. So the midrash says, HaTorah Omeret, the Torah would say, so
that's speak, early.
Yes. The concept, even if the midrash is not meant to be taken literally, there either right, it's not that we're looking at like, oh, there was a Torah scroll before whatever you say was the creation of Big Bang or the way Hashem made it. It's not like there was a Torah scroll, but spiritually, that is something that we can definitely take away, is that Hashem had the blueprints for the world for what is meant to be Torah mitzvahs prior to. In the Midrashim, I think it's even called Ish Shechor al Ish Levana, black fire on white fire. What exactly does that mean? It means something very spiritual. That's what the Shla and others talk about, how the Torah was really intended originally, to be something only for Malachim, only very spiritual, only for angels. When there was this, you know, so to speak, an argument between Moshe Rabbeinu and the angels, and by Shavuos time, not really Shavuos time, by the time of the first Shavuos, of the first giving of the Torah, so the angels were saying, you should give it to us, because the Torah was really intended for us. And the Torah was written in a way that could be interpreted for them, or could be interpreted for us. That's why some of the Shla and other Kabbalists take the...
What it says here, mm-hmm. what I take from this is that
yes.
what you just said, that mm-hmm. that how do we know, or why do we know, or why do we say that the Torah was before the world,
yeah.
was because the Torah was the blueprint for the world.
There you go.
And therefore, you don't have a house just built and then come up with the blueprints. you have the blueprints first, and then it. So therefore, we know that the Torah existed. I mean, I didn't make
probably,
that up. That's what it says here.
You could probably tell us.
Yeah, it's very good.
Carpeting, and also you got to be planning before.
Right.
You
it's good. It's
so,
good.
Yeah. It's good. So that's what this measure is talking about. People, the Zohar says a similar thing. Histalkaba, right? The Bara Alma. Hashem looked into the Torah and then created the world. The concept is a similar thing. So that's what, and it says something incredible, how Torah is so important. Okay, that's and so important. It's something fundamental. It's something that I talked about in Pirkei Avos here, and I'm going to go on. Was the Meshech Chachma says, hey, you could see Torah in two ways. You could see it through. He says this is represented by seeing the Luchos forward and backwards. You could see Torah through the written Torah that we have. You could also see it through nature, and you could see it says Avraham Avinu didn't have any when he was so to speak learning about Hashem. He just looked at the stars and looked at the sun and said, it's got to be some creator of the world. And the quote of Pasuk Yeshayahu, it's su'enechem shemayim, su'marom enechem, look at the skies and you'll see Hashem. There are psukim like that talk about seeing Hashem through nature. And the Meshech Chochma says that in some sense, they're just mirror images. If you know how to interpret the whole world, they know how to interpret the whole. Okay. So I want to talk now, going to, I guess, the days of the Purushim and the days of when did Machlokas in the world begin? Because a lot of our chain of Masorah is mostly we know people because of the Machlokas. And that's actually Rosh Shrier Gaon talks about this. Rosh Shrier Gaon lived...
You're talking about like a Machlokas in the Gemara type
yeah,
of?
Yeah, Machlokas in the Gemara. Okay. And
somebody disagreeing on
So Rosh Shrier Gaon lived around 1,000. He was way towards the end of the Gaonim, and he wrote a lot of what we know about the Gaonim was because of responsa. They asked people ask questions. So one of the questions they asked is, please tell us why do we follow the Gemara? So he says, oh, for me to tell you that I have to explain the whole history of Torah Shebaal Peh. And he wrote like a 40-page letter. So that is some of the very valuable history people learn about the Gaonim is from him. So this is just from the second page of it. He says, "Hachi havi milta derishonim." This is the way that things went in the days of. He doesn't mean the rishonim like we talk about them. He means this is how the early scholars always went in the following way. De lo yada shematon. We wouldn't know their names. Ela shematon de shematon. The Hebrew is somewhat Aramaic. El shel nasiim shel avo bezim. We'd only know basically one or two people in each generation. If you look in the beginning of Perkei Avos, we know from generation to generation about two people. Mm-hmm. How come? He says, mishum de lo havei machlokas binon. Because there was really no dispute, and when there's no dispute, so they were
you
trespassing.
Don't say Rosh Lachish says this, and
so you almost
that.
Don't need to mention them by name because right. Everybody was giving over something that was so clear to everybody from Moshe Rabbeinu until then. more or less. Ela kol tamei d'oraisa havi yadin lahon yadia berura. It was only very clear and obvious, and so there's no need to mention the person's name. So it went from one generation to another, and the Nevi'im, and the Shoftim, and the Malachim, and what he's arguing is it stayed that way with Amachokas, and this is a Gemara that says until the days of the Zugot, until the days of Rabbi Yossi, like till very late, let's say a few hundred BCE, was there one Machlokas. And that lasted for a bunch of generations until you get to Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai had a total of 3 Machlokas. How many Machlokas do you have between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai? So that's over 100. That's many. That's
so the first recorded
first is Rabbi Yossi ben Yoaz and Rabbi Yossi ben Yochanan.
And that was in the Gemara?
Gemara in Chagiga talks about this. Uh-huh. They had a machlokas that he's supposed to do smicha on Shabbos and Yantar.
Oh, uh-huh. We start from there? Okay, we're looking Beitza right now, so we're going over the Beitza of Beit Shammai goes. So we discuss is whether you have to do smicha on Yantar. You know, Beit Shammai goes and says you have to do it before, but you should do it the Erev.
Right, so that's.
Beit Hillel says, no, you're allowed to do it. You know.
Right, so I think that's I believe the Gemara records the first machlokas. What's the significance of that being the first one? I'm not so sure. But the Gemara says Hillel and Shammai only argue about 3 things, and then they're doing some new one. So why was there so much a multiplication of so much machlokas? Well, how come it erupted? So it says the Rosh Hashanah, the way he understands it, Mishum Hanach Mehumot Ushmadim Ush. V'shmadim, I guess that was it's a typo. V'shagushin, shehu ba'otos man, lo shimshu talmidim kol sarkav nefishi machlokas. What happened was there was a lot of trouble, tribulations, persecution in the world. So the students weren't able to learn as properly. So what happened was that people didn't learn as properly and there became machlokas. Part of this almost implies that had they learned more properly, they would have heard their rebbe and they would have heard the tradition more clearly, and there wouldn't be any machlokas.
Well, but they're blaming on persecution. You can't blame them.
It's true. Yeah. I'm not blaming them. I'm saying that's the way he tells the story.
Right.
As does Rashi. Rashi and Bava Metzia, when it's talking about this, is a discussion that the Gemara has about which is more important, to learn Gemara or to learn Mishnah.
Hello. What do you mean?
I didn't know what time we start tonight.
In that context, so the Gemara has that. First, it says it's better to learn Gemara than to learn Mishnah. There's a Gemara about Metzia, it goes back and forth, and then it says, Rebbe changes. Mine is much better to learn Mishnah than learn Gemara. And the Gemara says, why did that? Why do you say that? Basically, the Gemara says, because everybody made the first announcement, everybody left learning Mishnah and started learning Gemara. It was a lot more exciting. And so he said, if no one's going to learn the Mishnah, we're all going to forget it. This is before it was written. So therefore, he changed his mind. Now, Rashi tells a little bit of the story, a little bit of what was, I guess, behind the development of Mishnah. So he says, Hadik Tani, this is the third source, Hadik Tani Talmud, Ein Lecha Mida Gedol Mizu. Why is Gemara so great? This is really even before Gemara was the official Gemara like we have. This is just means what Gemara basically is. I think even the end of the Rashi explains it, is explaining the explanations of Mishnayos, explaining that they're not contradictory, explaining when there's missing words, what explanation you have to offer. That's what Gemara is basically all about, primarily, is to explain how to put together all the Mishnayos. So what happened? Why is Talmud so great? The more students that Shammai and Hillel had, they had 3 generations of students, and they were called Beit Shammai, called Beit Hillel, Rabu Machlok B'Torah. Through the generations of Shammai and Hillel students, lots of machlokas would happen. As we said before, there was 1 machlokas, and then Shammai and Hillel only had 3 machlokas, and their students had hundreds. And from there, it just kept growing and growing and growing. So today we have, on everything in the world almost, the right answer is machlokas. So, says Rashi.
It might be that they started getting into this questioning everything type of thing. Right. In other words, it's not like they had machlokas just for the same. They started learning together. They started having a lot of talmidim. Maybe before that, they didn't have a lot of talmidim, learning together and stuff like that. Then all of a sudden, everybody's learning together. They says, well, look at this. And they started reasoning and everything. And that's how maybe the Gemara Cup started happening. Maybe before that, they didn't have that.
Okay, that's definitely possible.
I'm just
possible.
Making that up.
It's definitely possible. The way Rashi puts the story. But that is possible and plausible. So says Rashi, what happened is that as the students increased and more machlokas came about, Nasu Kishtei Torahs, it looked so bad that it was almost like there were 2 Torahs. There was a Torah of Shammai and a Torah of Hillel because you couldn't match them up. It didn't look like day or day and night the way they explained things. Mitosha Ol Hashibud, Ol Shibud Malchiyud V'gzeiro, which goes in a lamp, he points basically to the same factors Rashi Ragon pointed to, which is, he said it's basically because of the difficulty of the ruling power of the Romans or the Greeks, well, let's say the Romans at the times of the Mishnayos, were so tough on them, their persecution was so bad, and the gezeros that they made, the decrees they made against them were so tough, they mitoch kach lo hayichol leteiliv levar divrei chalukim ad yamam shel rabbi. They basically didn't have a chance, an opportunity to really discuss it, to figure out what was the answer, to clarify the machlokah. The more machlokah came about because of the lack of clarity. He says, how did Rebbe have an opportunity to put together Mishnah? He said, because Rebbe has special grace with the king. He was friends with the king. He was a wealthy person, Rebbe, and he was a respected person. And it says he and Antoninus had conversations, and Antoninus was a powerful king at the time, so he gave Rebbe certain opportunity. This was 200 or so CE, and he gave him certain luxuries that he was able to have gatherings of the rabbis in his time, something that was not quite as possible before. And what did he do with that opportunity? He decided to gather all the rabbis, have them explain what they learned and what they think, what they heard. And this way, they put together the Mishnahs with a collection of all of the Shmuel, all the hearings, all the oral testimonies, and whatever.
During the time of the second base of English?
This is way
past
after.
Way
past the second base of English?
Right,
like
so
200 years past,
yeah, 200 years after, that's when. So in the times of the Beis Hamikdash, you had Hillel and Shammai. They were towards the end of the second Beis Hamikdash. It says in the Gemara they personally lived 100 years before the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. Rabbi Akiva, who was a few generations after Hillel and Shammai, a number of generations, he lived at the time of the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. So, okay. In any event, so that's the way Rashi and Rashi Ragon want to explain how the development of Machlokas happened, because it's not part of the thing they're avoiding. And a question we're going to deal with now is the question that they're addressing, let me say it better like this, the question they're addressing is, did we know the Torah before and it was very clear and obvious what the halachas were in every case, and we forgot them, whether it is on purpose or more likely it's because of persecution, or is it that we just never developed, we never thought about those cases, a little bit like Ellie was describing before, we never talked about certain cases before in history, it never came up, it was never thought about, so that's why there was machloket on cases that were never described previously, and had they discussed it, they may have been a machlokas. Those are the two ways of explaining how there could be a machlokas. Both Rashi and Shurgon are more like the first explanation, which is maybe it's not to any fault of our own, but we had forgotten a little bit of Torah over the centuries. Could be, part is right. Could be both explanations are right in different areas.
So nothing was written down before that.
Nothing was written before Rebbe for sure. The Rambam talks about how it was, in the Gemara describes it, was usher to write down.
Right.
The Gemara in Gittin Samach, it says, you can write Torah Shebichtav, you're not supposed to even memorize it, but you're not allowed to write Torah Shebaal Peh. However, the Rambam says that people used to write, as an introduction to the Mishnah Torah, people used to write notes. If they heard a shir, they heard something from their rabbi, and they want to remember, they're allowed to write notes for themselves, they're not allowed to publish it, they're not allowed to give it to other people. They have to keep it for themselves, just so this way, if they want to tell it to somebody else, and they forgot it, they can look it up. So probably there was almost nothing, or very little written, if anything. There's a big question in historians, in the Rishonim, Achronim, or mostly Achronim, what did Rebbe, when he compiled the Mishnayos, did he actually write anything, or it was all oral? Even at his time, even though he organized it, was it still kept orally? That's a question. Some say it's a machloka, Rambam and Rashi, but I'm not sure there's anything so clear on this. Some people say it's a misprint in the Rambam that he wrote it. Really, it's everybody's Simas of Zohar. Okay, in any event, it certainly became written, more things became written in the days of the Gaonim and Savarim, after the days of the Gemara was Savarim and then Gaonim. So we certainly have old texts of Gemaras from the day, from already the days of the Gaonim. I don't know the exact years, but we do definitely have certain, and even different versions of different Gemaras from the days of the Gaonim. That was in the years between 500 and 1,000.
That's when certain things, a lot more things, were being written, because part of it was, that's why the Gemara in Gittin says why we're allowed to write Torah, is because we're afraid we're going to all forget it all. So, good thing that we wrote it down. Okay, yeah. So I want to investigate that question a little bit more. Is it possible to say that we sort of knew a lot of Torah and we sort of forgot it? The Rambam, I'm going to first present the opposite approach, and I'm going to present the Rambam, but I want to say perhaps the question, just to build up the tension. The Rambam says, is it possible to believe that something that was like the most precious thing to the Jewish people, and one of the most precious things, was our tradition, our Torah Sheba'al Peh, was forgotten over the generations? That's why there was so much machloka, so much dispute, that we just don't know anything because it was forgotten in this generation, forgotten again, and that's why there's so much dispute. It's a little bit a depressing story, the way you say it, is that because there was persecution, that's why we forgot the way the Beis HaMikdash looked, or the Avodah looked, or the way that you're supposed to build the sukkah, even we have machlokas. It's supposed to be three walls or four walls. Basically, machlokas about everything in Torah is because we forgot so much. The Ram doesn't believe that to be the case, because it can't be that Klaus would have forgotten something that was so important. Also, maybe
it's heretical to go over and say that everyone forgot.
I wouldn't say heretical, but he doesn't want to say this. Now, based on the Rashi and Rosh Hashanah, it could be they would say that. Now, they may say it's not everything, but that's part of it. Mm-hmm. Now, there is an opposite approach, basically similar to those two first approaches, which actually implies Moshe, and this goes to a bigger question, and this may be, I wouldn't say anybody's heretical, but this gets already to a harder question. What did Moshe Rabbeinu get in Har Sinai? What do you think?
He got Torah Kulo. So you got the
so what does that include?
Well, that's interesting, because at Har Sinai, he didn't, obviously, the entire Sefer Torah wasn't written yet. According to, it depends who you're looking at. Yes. You know, one.
But let's say the end of his life. He already had a whole Sefer. What did he know? Did he know what we have later in the Mishnah?
Yes, because if you remember, he was taken into a kita where he was teaching, Rabbi Akiva was teaching, and he was going over and talking about, even on top of the letters, they go over and they have the crowns. And it goes over, and so obviously, even Moshe even went over and saw that.
Good, perfect. So I have that story. We're going to get to that one story. What do you think? What emotion now? How much did he learn? I'll take the harder question. Did he learn Mishnah Berurah? That was only about a century ago.
Okay.
He got a blueprint, but not every exact detail.
I like that. That's a very possible problem. So that's the question that we're going to address, is how much of Torah you get? And some people will be startled to see, right, maybe he didn't get absolutely everything, but what about the Gemara that talks about he did get a lot?
Right.
Okay. There's
another thing that we've been discussing. I just went out of my head. If I remember again, I'll say it again. I forgot.
I'll read last of the story.
So he's pointing out that, part of the reason why Machloket did come into existence, even to this day, is because we do admit that we're not as great as the generations that were there previously.
Yes, there are us.
Right. So there's no question that we're losing.
Absolutely. Okay. So that even there could be
everything. If technology is changing nowadays, it didn't have thousands of years ago.
So on that question, I think head on the nail on the head. I think it's hard to answer if you're going to take the first approach. Though you could, if you take the second approach, you just got the blueprint, so the answer is easy. Mm-hmm. He didn't get the answer on how to deal with a microwave if you could use it on Shabbos, mm-hmm. or for milk and meat. He got the general principles, and he works to that, and we can work it out ourselves. If you take the first approach, it's possible, but it's very strange. He got benevuah, almost everything, even on the microwaves, even on the airplane Shabbos, but he didn't transfer those. He didn't remember those, or he didn't give those over. It's a little bit harder to say, but there are sources. I want to just say outside a little bit of this. We're dealing with the question of how much Torah did Moshe hear from Har Sinai. So the first one is Yerushalmi. It's quoted by a bunch of Rishonim. Important. It says, Afilu Masha Talmud Vatik Ati Lahora. At the bottom on the first page, it says, whatever a good student was later going to paskin, later going to decide, Lefnei Rabbu Kvar Nemar L'Moshe V'Sino. That everything, basically, it sounds like, that anybody's going to later paskin in later generations on the microwave, on the oven, or on anything, on Hechos Tvila, Moshe got in Har Sinai. The Derabans, the Derais, the Menhagim. That's what it sounds like in the Gemara. And it quotes basically a pasuk in Koheles. It says, the theme in Koheles a lot in the first parak is, Echash Tachar Hashem, is nothing new. So it says, Yish Davar Shiomar Adam. A person might just say, oh, Reze Chadashu. Look, this is a new thing I found. And Meshivu Chaver Amar Lo Kvar Haya Lo Olamin. It was always around. So the Gemara Yerushalmi is interpreting that pasuk not just the way we think about it. It's just true. Also, there's history repeats itself, and that's what Qohelet's somewhat trying to teach us, and maybe depressing, but a lot of things in history aren't really so new. But he says that even in Torah, maybe everything in Torah, you can always point back, oh, actually, it was said earlier, because Moshe Rabbeinu actually, in theory, got everything of Torah.
I would interpret it that that you could apply the Torah and what happened in the past to anything that comes along today. In other words, a microwave comes along today. You can say, well, as we're talking about something years ago, a donkey and a rooster, you know? And since okay. we posking the way of a donkey and a rooster, therefore the microwave is, puzzle.
Okay.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, they do that. That's
Morty says it was basically
a blueprint or principles.
Right? Yeah.
So the good. It's definitely an approach. Right. But the literal way it sounds like he got
it. Yeah, okay. So you can believe that if you want to.
I'm not going to pick a side, but I'll
me
say
neither.
I'm going to explain the different approaches.
All the other cases coming out.
Okay.
So therefore, he did that.
He didn't publicize it. That's possible.
Well, they have all these, what do they call it? You know, when you read the thing and then you pull out words and then you find, the Six-Day War,
the codes.
They exist. So if the codes are true,
there you are. Everything is.
Yeah.
I'll stay in the Gemara.
That's right. I'll stay in the Gemara.
Yes. Okay. I'll go so far. Fine. Okay. The Gemara Megillah has a similar idea. It basically says that Moshe even knew about things that were going to be later enacted, like Megillah, which is Dirabonon, but yet Moshe knew about that as well. And it gets it from a different pasuk. The Ran, who's a Rishon, important Rishon, in the 1300s, I'll mention him later.
And they say the same thing with Hanukkah, right? They bring Rias in the
Gemara doesn't talk much about
Hanukkah because it was later.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Either it's later or it's intentionally left out. There's different versions because it was done by.
The
Gemara does talk about Hanukkah and like Chaf. Aleph in Shabbos. It's like for three daf. But in the Mishnayos, I think it appears three times or so, and it's all Agav. Every time it doesn't teach you a halacha about Hanukkah. So there's different reasons why that is. Meaning, it's true. We do know about Hanukkah in the Gemara, but it's all three pages or something as opposed to Megillah, which we have 20 or something. It could be because it's later. That's possible. That's reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In any event, the Ran's approach on this is absolutely Moshe Rabbeinu got everything like it sounds like in the Gemara, and he explains that he got Kol Dikduke Torah, all the details, Dikduke Sofrim, all the ins and outs of what we have in our Torah, all the ins and outs of the rabbis and all the disputes, and he says all that was told to Moshe Rabbeinu, and nonetheless something else that's important is yes. He got everything, but the hachra, the decision, is going to be made in each generation according to the rabbis of that generation. So it could be Moshe Rabbeinu did hear the discussion, according to the Ran, the dispute that people are going to have about, I don't know, something strange, something that's relevant today, about...
Dabbling on an airplane.
Dabbling on an airplane, okay, whatever it may be. And he didn't hear the answer, and even if he told people principles, it doesn't matter because... The discussions that we're having today are going to be the final decision. And he quotes there, I didn't put it here, the story with Rabbi Eliezer and the other rabbis, Rabbi Yeshua and others, the Tanur Shachnai. There was an oven that had a big shiloh, was it Tamir Tahar? And Rabbi Eliezer said, I'm right, that it was Tahar. And he said, if I'm right, let the water show that I'm right. And the water started going backwards. And he said, I'm right, let the tree uproot itself in the tree. And then he said, if I'm right, let the wall show that I'm right. And the wall started to fall in. So the rabbi said, Rabbi Yeshua stood up on his feet and said, you all have no business being involved with this. This is our machlokas. So Bakal came out and said, Rabbi Eliezer is right. You should follow him. It's an angel came out. And the Gemara says, Rabbi Yeshua said, they exclaimed, no, lo b'shamayim, we don't follow that. And that's what the Ran is basing himself on. Yes, even if things were given to Moshe Rabbeinu and he was given the blueprints or principles or maybe everything or given a lot of even later machlokas, doesn't matter. He's still in Paskin on those shilas. Except what we have in our actual Torah Shebichtav. That's something that we know that Moshe wrote down. Yes.
Moshe wanted Torah to evolve all the generations. Future. He would tell us everything within more words, and Torah was that.
Basically, yes.
But also, you have to, the world changes, and you can't have everything like this because the world is like this, and therefore you have to change. I mean, you don't have to necessarily change the religion. I'm not saying chas v'shalom that. But what I am saying is you have to be able to, like he says, to evolve. And
right.
It doesn't necessarily mean change,
yes.
just grow with it.
That's true. There's an interesting Yerushalmi that the Dor Ravi, who is an interesting great great grandson of the Chasam Sofer, talks about. It's important that says that if the Torah wouldn't have given Torah Shebaal Peh and just had Torah Shebachtav, we were like the carrot, then it would be the Yerushalmi has the expression. It would be like a body without legs. It would be like a Torah that wouldn't be able to be applied for another generation because. Yes, it says in the Torah X, Y, and Z, but it's very difficult to figure out how everything applies to every year and every generation, how life should go on. So that's an important discussion. I mentioned different opinions, and the bottom opinion here was just interesting about how chidushim in Torah evolve. And if you take the approach of the Ran, of what we said, basically Moshe got everything, so how can he ever have a chidush? How can he ever have something new? Moshe already got everything, and that's what basically the Pasuk in Kohelet said. Everything that's new is really old. So the Torah's Chaim, who is basically a 1600 rabbi, important prayer on the Gemara, he says, even if it's basically rediscovering something that's old, but it's done through coming in contact and encountering the Ruach HaKodesh of what the Torah really wants to be the truth, that's a chiddush also. That's something that we're rediscovering, coming to something. Finding something that's special. That's already a chiddush. And he said, that's what the Gemara talks about, that when Nevuah left the world, when prophecy left the world, so Hashem gave Ruach HaKodesh to the rabbis. And he said, he quotes a whole discussion, but the Gemara says that after Hashem's voice stopped at Har Sinai, it says, Kol Yasaf, the voice, or either the shofar of Hashem, didn't stop going. And the Mishnah Perkei Avos talks about there's a bakol that yotzei from Har Sinai every day. He says, what does that mean that Hashem's voice at Har Sinai didn't stop? We don't hear anything now. He said, that is the Ruach HaKodesh that continues every day when we're learning, when we think about things. That's what the Torah Chaim says. It could be rediscovering, reconnecting, figuring out things. To figure out what does Hashem really want is also important Chiddush. The Rambam, however, and I just want to mention this, to mention very close to what Morty was saying, was he believes that not everything was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe got the Torah Shebachtav. He got the major principles, let's say the Yud Gimel Midrash HaTorah Nedrash Baham, the 13 principles of how we learn Torah, and then things which were never given to Moshe Rabbeinu, were not given through prophecy, are discussed in each generation. And that's how we have disputes. Disputes is not so much because we forgot Torah as much as it is we never knew the answers yet. We never thought about it. We never had the case that was came up. So that could be the Rambam's explanation of how we have so much dispute, but it's not so much as a result of forgetting. It's just a different approach to the way the world, the way the history of disputes came about. Okay, and that with that, I want to mention one fascinating story. No, I'll come back to the story. I want to say right now what I have on the last two pages. I'll pass this around. Is a timeline of our Mesorah, basically starting from the one on page 4 just has. Let's say a little short, quick timeline, starting from the Avos, going to the Shoftim, going to the Nevi'im, going to the Zugos, Tanayim, through the days of the Mishnayos, through the days of the Bayit Sheni, through the Mishnayos, through the Gemara, Amoraim were the days of the Gemara, then you have the Savarim who edited the Gemara. We have very little history from them. Then you have the Gaonim, who are from 500 to 1,000. Then you have the Rishonim, then you have the Achronim. And that covers the Mesorah for the last, 3,000 years, from the Tims, Matan Torah, to now. And the other chart I put down there has a little bit more names, but basically a lot of it's been documented from generation to generation. Now, we have a lot more documentation in the last 1,000 years when people have written. And we know stories that people have interacted. And I made this chart. So the first, most of them, especially the Ashkenazic side, was a friend of mine, Michael Weingarten, who was in Halsworth. He made the list up to on the Ashkenazi side up to Rav Schechter. I added the Sephardi section. Yeah. And what this does is it tries as best as possible to show from student to student, or from generation to generation at least, of scholars of the generation, some of the leading scholars from each generation, from Matan Torah till today. And he did it partly because the Rambam, in his introduction to the Mishnah Torah, does something very incredible. He does something very important. He talks about how from the times of Moshe Rabbeinu until the times of Rebbe, there was 40 generations. And he gets that from looking in Pirkei. Oh, it starts with the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, Moshe Kibbel Torah Mesinai. Okay, and then you go through the first parak. But after that, you have to look at search through the rest of the Gemara to figure out each generation. But he does it. He gets about 40 generations, starting from Moshe Rabbeinu, going through different Nevi'im, getting to Rebbe. Rebbe was the author, the compiler of all the Mishnayos. And then going from Rebbe to his generation, he gets about another 40 generations. The Rambam writes, and that's including Roshur Gaon and the other Gaonim that we know about. He writes from generation to generation, student to student, we have a tradition going back to Har Sinai. So it's about roughly 80 generations. Some generations know a lot more about, some a lot less. And then the Meiri, who lived about another, he lived in Provence, 1300, another 150 or so years after the Rambam, he wrote from the first 80 generations, then he wrote a few more generations from the Rambam's time to his time. Then we don't have, the rest of this is basically put together using Wikipedia and other sources online of history. I put together the Sephardi section basically going from page to page on Wikipedia, looking at different rabbis or who their rabbis were. I was mostly focused on in the Sephardi world in the rabbis in Israel, though lots of the rabbis were either in Turkey or in Baghdad. That's where the main centers of Sephardi Jewry. There was Morocco, there was Syria, there was a bunch of other places. But the biggest centers of Torah was Israel, Turkey, and Baghdad. And I went through it, and I tried to do my best to show from generation to generation. I was thinking, mention more stories. I don't think I'm going to mention so many of them. Let's say one of them just comes to mind was the Rav Chaim Palagi. He was a Sephardi. He was a rabbi of Turkey. He was what they had in the Ottoman Empire. This was in the late 1700s. They had an appointed chief rabbi of a country that had something to do with the government. That was centuries ago, that was something that was established, similar to like the Ashkenazi Kehillah system. I think in the Ottoman Empire, they had for either towns or countries, they had some rabbis or some officials that would have something to do with the government, probably having to do with either taxes or something. It was not the same Kehillah system as for Ashkenaz. With the citizens of the Arab world mostly dealt with the other Arabs and dealt with the government directly. But there was still such a thing as a chief rabbi. So Rav Chaim Palagi lived in the late 1700s, lived into the 1800s. He wrote many books, and 70 or so, a number of them were burnt in his lifetime. There was some fire in his house, and a bunch of them are printed. Half of them are Kabbalistic, and some of them are not so popular. There's a Haggadah that came out not so long ago, and I had it, and I have it, and I think it's great. But, okay, he was a Sephardi rabbi. He's quoted by Rav Adya Yosef and others, but not in the general world, not so famous.
He's not on your list.
Rav Chaim Palagi, I better put him. I hope I put him somewhere.
What
sorry.
Number?
He is.
I don't see. I see 1700. So.
Oh no, you are right. Mm. I didn't put him here.
He's been around Ben Chaim Chazan.
Yeah, he was around then. He was 100% around then. So.
Ah, you laid him.
I forgot him.
The next time you do it.
All right. Too bad. That's my fault. So. He had a correspondence with the father of the Ben Ishchai. The Ben Ishchai, Rav Yosef Chaim, he is on my list. Okay, I didn't forget him. The Ben Ishchai was in the 1800s into the 1900s, and the Ben Ishchai's father, had a correspondence with the Rav Chaim Palagi. They lived in Baghdad, the Ben Ishchai. And his son, the Ben Ishchai, heard the Shaila and decided, okay, I'll write an answer, what I think is the answer. So he wrote an answer. Rav Chaim Palagi sent the letter back, and this whole discussion to Rav Ben Ishchai's father, saying, "I got your answer, but I like your son's answer better. I hope he'll become a gadol one day." So the Ben Ishchai is famous, at least more famous in the Sephardi world, as having some say in the world of Torah. Ben Ishchai is an important rabbi. You know, coming after him, there was a Kaf HaChaim, and then there's a Rav Kaduri. They learned from the Ben Ishchai. They're definitely. So many people who learned Islam Ben Ishchai or from students of them to this day. One of them was, let's say, the Kaf HaChaim. He lived basically contemporaneous with the Chafetz Chaim, with the Mishnah Berurah, and he writes a work on Or HaChaim that's similar to the Mishnah Berurah. And he moved to Israel, and Rav Adya Yosef knew him. And The last chapters of the Kaf HaChaim were written by his family after the Kaf HaChaim passed away. He asked Rav Adi Yosef to write it. So I put him, Rav Adi Yosef, coming a generation after Kaf HaChaim. But I could speak, you know, about each one of them, probably, or hopefully. But every generation has its story. And mention just one other highlight was Rash in the Ramah and his cousin, the Marshal, were very important in the Ashkenazi world, especially of Halacha, in the 1500s. Late 1500s, the Marshal traces their genealogy back to Rashi, and through the Baal Yetzoses, and some of that's over here, but that was important because the main stages of all time for Ashkenazi Jewry was the Baal Yetzoses, Rashi and Baal Yetzoses. So if they trace their genealogy there, that was good yichas, so to speak. And it continues from there. And my friend Michael Wonga was really trying to show from Moshe Rabbeinu down to Roshechter. Just because if we're going from, let's say, the Vilna Gaon to today, to Rav Soloveitchik, it's not so difficult. There's not so many generations because it's mostly through the Lajan Yeshiva. Lajan Yeshiva was in the 1800s. It covers a few generations. So some of that's already documented and easier to cover. I'll mention one other story and end with this. This story that we mentioned before. It says in the Gemara Menachos, Chavtas, it says, Moshe saw Hashem was writing the crowns of the letters. And he asked him, I'll pass this around, sorry, this is the color one. I didn't make them all the color. Right? Whoever wants to say it. So he said, why are you writing the crowns? Who's Akiv El Yadcha? Who's stopping you? So said Hashem, you know there's going to be a sage many generations later, his name is Rabbi Akiva, he's going to darshan every single tag, every single crown of the letter. That's why I'm putting it on. Okay. So Rabbi said, or Moshe Rabbeinu said, let me see his shear. Let me listen to him. Let me see him because he's probably much more worthy than I. So he goes and sits in the back of the Rabbi Akiva's shear and he hears the shear and he's astounded. And he says it has chalash daite, he feels bad. Tashash kocho, he feels bad because he doesn't understand what Rabbi Akiva is talking about. And then it says finally at the end, Rabbi Akiva says, so the one in Talmidim asked Rabbi Akiva, how did you get this? And he says, oh, it was halacha Moshe Sinai. God, it goes back from a tradition from Moshe, and Moshe feels a lot better. The question is a little bit appalling, a little bit big question to ask, is how come Moshe didn't understand the conversation, and yet they said it was halacha Moshe Sinai, it goes back to Moshe. If it goes back to Moshe, well, then you see, you should understand it. So, I'll say one idea in one sentence, and then one to end with. Rav Dessler says, there's different ways of getting something to something. There's an internal way and an external way. One, something that you have to derive a lot harder. Moshe knew the emes. He knew the bottom lines. He didn't. The whole way that Rabbi Akiva derived something was a pilpul, was a whole discussion. But Rav Sadok HaKohen, one of the big chassidim, he said a whole different explanation having to do with a very important Gemara of Nedarim that says, if not for the sins of the Jewish people, the Chet Egel being one of them, Hashem wouldn't have had to give so much Torah. It says in the Pasuk in Kohelet, Barov Chachma, Rov Kas. So to speak, Hashem's anger caused there to be more Torah. What does that mean? If we didn't sin so much, so to speak, Hashem wouldn't have needed to clarify Torah again and again, with more Nevi'im and this Musar and that, and the more Torah and Torah Shabbat Peh and everything else. He said, Moshe didn't understand what Rabbi Akiva was talking about because that was because things became so confusing over all the generations that Hashem had to add more and more Torah, so to speak, that it wasn't clear to everybody what the pure MS was. So that's why Moshe's made, but the kernel of truth, the absolute Torah that was behind it, all does come derived back from Moshe Rabbeinu, as is the principles. But that's Gemara and different ideas about it.
I don't know if we answered it.
I
dabbed
already. You two are going
down.
What time is it
going to
be next week? With
Myrav,
so
yeah.
Now.
I don't know. I'd
I think
be happy
you should go
to
right
do
after
it.
Myrav, no?
I'd be happy to do it then. And just go from the right tomorrow. You're saying?
Would that be okay with you?
That'd be good with me.
Myrav is this week at 7:50. Next week is 7:55.